So, good morning. A couple of things before we get started. In the mornings before church worship service, we are having some refreshments and things to drink over there. It begins around, is it 10 o'clock? Is that when it begins? And so, you know, it's very difficult to even get things like Sunday school just because of people's schedules and things like that. So, we have this impromptu time between 10 and, say, 10:40 where people can meet back here and just show up and have some great conversation. Maybe you want to talk about some things related to the sermon before or something that you read during the course of the week, and just an impromptu, informal time to really connect with people in the body here. So we hope you take advantage of it. Rocky and Bonnie have really put some time and effort into it, and I think it would be a great opportunity. So feel free to take advantage of that in any way that you can. So there's that. And then I wanted to mention, there was something else. It is. It's terrible when you get old. I heard a bunch of robins tweeting this morning. Okay. So I thought maybe I'd mention that to you. So, you know, maybe you winter haters would be happy about that or whatever. So, well, hey, so we're continuing on in the series. And look, I just want to tell you in this First Peter book that, you know, I mean, there's just so much there. And there's so much that I don't have time to say. And so if we creep along on it and go kind of slow, it's only because I want to try and get to the depths and the riches of the text itself. And so I hope that you don't get bored with it and that you stay with me on it. But it's, you know, I mean, there's just some wonderful things associated with it that I think are life-changing, conceivably for all of us. So if you want and if you can, just hang in there with me on that, because also I think that it's a text that is very relevant and very pertinent to our time, and I think that you'll see that today, it's one thing to read the text as it was written back then to whomever it was written and to glean from it what was being communicated. It's another thing to take all of that and then to apply it to our lives now. Like, if it was true then, if it meant something then, what does it mean to us now? Why is it relevant? And I think that that's where many of us kind of miss the boat. And so hopefully we can bring some of its relevancy out for all of us here, because I think that, you know, to pick up this theme that we've been using, you know, Peter was a man for his time, and you and I have been created by God to be people for our time. And indeed, that is the premise by which many of us will be judged. How we were or were not people of our time, faithful and obedient to Christ in the place that he has placed us. So just very quickly, because there are some newer people here, and it's been 2 weeks since we've met. This is a circular letter that was written to Christians who were dispersed throughout what is called Asia Minor today. Well, it was Asia Minor then. It's Turkey, modern-day Turkey today. This was a letter crafted to prepare, encourage, exhort, and provide practical guidance for Christians who were enduring persecution, Christians who have been isolated, Christians who have been alienated because of their faith. And so the Apostle Peter was writing this letter to believers to encourage them in their exile, in their alienation, in their persecution, because of what they believed. And I'm going to have a little more to say about that in a few minutes as well. This letter is important. It's very important because this letter, as well as Ephesians and Galatians, other letters that were crafted to those Christians in Asia Minor, those letters shaped those churches and those Christians in such a powerful way that those churches produced some of the church's most important theologians in the history of the church. The Christian theologians who came out of Asia Minor, what you worship today is linked directly to what they wrote. And what they wrote was influenced by letters like 1 Peter, the Epistle of Ephesians, Galatians, letters like that. So it's very important then to keep all of that in mind. So if it was that powerful then in terms of how it shaped people, could it be true that this letter could shape us as well? That we in turn could be equally influenced in a powerful way so that we have the same kind of impact upon the world in which we live? I think that's true. And I think that's in part why it's relevant for us today. So what we've learned so far is that we've discussed the importance of what's called the Petrine authorship, the fact that it was a disciple of Jesus who was an apostle, and out of that authority he was writing those letters. It's a timeless letter, and the purpose of which is relevant for both then and today. And so it had an incredible impact regionally and historically. It really focuses on the magnificence of how Christians then were saved from their paganism and to Christ. And that salvation was a magnificent salvation. It was the kind of salvation that no other religion could produce. And it's also the kind of letter that helps to provide a contrast between Christianity and the ancient paganism of the day. So let's read then from 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 1 through 12. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who are elect exiles in the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, according to the foreknowledge of God the Father, in the sanctification of the Spirit, for obedience to Jesus Christ, and for the sprinkling of His blood, may His grace and peace be multiplied to you. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. According to His great mercy, He has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, and unfading, kept in heaven for you, who, by God's power, are being guarded through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. In this you rejoice. So is Peter assuming that? Is that a presumption of his? Given the kind of salvation that Jesus accorded those Christians, Peter goes on to say, because of the way in which you were saved, because of everything that He has done, because of the manner in which He did it, because of the way in which this is so much of a better faith than any other faith that you could know, do you rejoice because of it? So is joy, is rejoicing a regular part of how we express our faith because of this magnificent faith that Jesus Christ has given to us? I've often said that joy ought to be one of the very clear distinctives of Christians that separates us from the rest of the world. That they should know a Christian because of the rejoicing, because of the joy that's a regular part of their life. And if that joy isn't there, then something really is wrong. We are disconnected from this magnificent faith. So, in this you rejoice, though now for a little while, for if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials. And then Peter continues, So that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold, that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So the trials and tests, he's saying to you, you have been tested by those. And in that testing, you've been purified. And that purification should also cause joy and rejoicing as well. Verse 8, though you have not seen him, you love him. Though you do not see him, you believe in him and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory. Again, we come back to this joy thing, even in the midst of trials. So here are all these Christians in Asia Minor experiencing trials and tests and persecution and being exiled and alienated from other communities. And what is their response? The response is that through those trials and tests and difficulties, that they have emerged stronger and better. They love him even more. They believe in him even more. And they rejoice with a joy that is inexpressible. So I wonder what that might have been like for pagans, for non-believers, for people from other religious faiths to see what was happening to Christians in that day and at that time, to be abused, to be cursed, to be exiled, to be excluded. And what was their response? I know whom I have believed and am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I've committed unto him against that day. And I will do that joyfully. In fact, there's so much joy that it's inexpressible. I don't know about you, but probably in my life, there have been only a few times when I've experienced joy so much that it was inexpressible. And that's tragic. I mean, especially for a pastor, you know, of all people, I should have more joy, right? I should be a good example in that regard, but I'm not as good of an example as I should be. So the Apostle Peter is reminding them of this phenomenal thing that Christ has done for them, and for them to remember that in the midst of those difficulties, and to grow stronger because of those difficulties, and to still have a joy that is inexpressible. Then he goes on to say, obtaining the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Concerning this salvation, the prophets who prophesied about the grace that was to be yours searched and inquired carefully, inquiring what person or time the Spirit of Christ in them was indicating when he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the subsequent glories. It was revealed to them that they were serving not themselves, but you. So in this text here then, he's saying, look, there were prophets in times past who knew that Jesus Christ was going to come. And they were trying to figure out who he was and when he might come, but it was kind of darkened to them. They couldn't know. They didn't know for sure. But you know. You've experienced it. All of these great people like Elisha and Daniel, Elijah, Isaiah, Ezekiel, the judges like Samuel, all of these people had a sense that there was going to be this Messiah, and they were curious. They wondered when and who and how this might happen. Now you know. You know something. You have experienced something that these great people were never privy to. And not only that, then he goes on to say, it was even hidden from the angels. They didn't know. And you now know and have experienced something that they didn't know. This is what Christ has done for you, he says. And this is what Christ has done for us. So what Peter exhorts those Christians in Asia Minor to do then, he also exhorts us to do today. Regardless of whatever persecution we might experience, whatever exclusion might happen, whatever hate speech we might receive because of what we believe, he's saying, remember the gospel. Remember the great thing that Jesus Christ has done for you, the nature and substance of our great salvation through and in Jesus Christ. So now that we've talked about this, it seems to me that I should spend a little bit of time on some practical application. So I will try and get to as much of this as I possibly can, and I may not be able to get to all of it. If not, then I will have to pick it up next week. I'm doing this because the Apostle Peter was writing to Christians who were exiled and persecuted because of what they believed. They lived in a culture that was adversarial to what they believed and to whom they believed in. That world, at first, did not understand why anybody would believe in this God named Jesus Christ. Which is why many Christians were considered to be atheists, because they were monotheistic. They only believed in one God, and to almost anybody in that day, that was absurd. It was ridiculous that there could only be one God. Not only that, but that these Christians claimed that this was the one God, the supreme God, above all other gods. Even if there were other gods, he was the God. So with that and many other things, Christians were oftentimes reviled, especially the first two or three centuries of that time. So they had to counter other worldviews in other religions. They had to understand what it was that they were up against. So during that time, there were people who were called apologists. Now, you and I understand apology as like, I'm sorry, I did this. An apologist, in its original and technical term, means the defense of, to defend. So there were many people who rose. Some of these great theologians who came out of Asia Minor were great apologists. And they helped Christians to articulate their faith over and against, in a convincing manner, existing worldviews, religions, and ideologies and philosophies. Look, this is what they believe. This is why it's bad to believe this. This is how you have this debate or conversation. This is how you engage them in a loving, Christ-like manner. That was the apologist. Today, you and I live in a culture where most of the culture do not believe what you believe. I understand that the majority of people claim to be either Judeo-Christian in their worldview or Christian. But a sizable percentage of those people do not know what they believe. They think they know, but they don't know. And then there's a sizable percentage of people in our culture who are anti-Christian, virulently so in many respects, adversarial. And they think they know what you believe, but they don't know because they have been misinformed and even malinformed. So I want to talk about that today. I want to spend a few moments talking about what kind of worldview or ideology or philosophy of life do you and I have to face on a regular basis? Now, maybe some other Christians would say, well, yeah, it's because we live in this like polytheistic world, and so there are Muslims and there are people from India and blah, 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 blah. There is that. But there is an overarching worldview, an ideology that is above all of that and reserves for itself the privilege of holding judgment over all the religious faiths. It exists, and it has never been more prevalent than what it is today. So to begin with, then, I want to say this. First, steadfast, faithful obedience to Christ is often what causes exile and persecution, not what enables us to avoid it, necessarily. So just because you are a good Christian doesn't mean that you get to escape persecution or somebody who doesn't like Christians or whatever. That may actually attract people to say something about you because of your faith. Now, I am 61 years of age. I came to faith when I was about 10. So for 51 years or so, I have been a Christian. By the time I was 18 or 19 years of age, my Christian worldview was pretty much set. Fundamentally and foundationally, I understood what I believed. And it hasn't changed. It's gotten a little more sophisticated because of education and experience, but what I believed and what I practiced as a believer, as a Christian at 18 years of age, is really not that much different than what I believe and practice now at 61 years of age. Now, when I was 18, and I would share with people in my life that I was a Christian, and even if they weren't believers, they had some respect for the fact that I had made this choice and that I wanted to live my life in these kinds of ways and that these were my values and my morals and this is how I practiced my faith. That has not changed. But today, in this world in which we live, the culture in which we find ourselves, I'm a radical. I am an extremist. I am hateful. I am intolerant. I have not changed. The world has changed. The culture has changed. And it's demanding that I change with them. Maybe some of you can relate to that. You know what it is that I'm talking about. That, you know, while you may have grown in your understanding of scriptures, you may have a deeper walk with Jesus Christ, that shortly after, relatively speaking, shortly after you came to faith in Christ, while you grew in your knowledge, your worldview, what you believed, is pretty much the same today as it was back then. But now, for many people in our culture, the social elites, you and I are to be reviled because we will not get in line and think and believe like them. So in the same way that Christians oftentimes got in trouble during Peter's day, so Christians get in trouble today because of what they believe, because of their orthodox belief. And that will only increase more. That will not decrease any less. And that is why, in part, why communities like this are so very important. Because when Christians become isolated, Christians become vulnerable. When Christians are not a regular part of a community of faith, when we are not dependent upon each other, when we are not praying for each other, when we come to, so, and the other part of that that's just so powerful is that when Christians come together and live in a unified community, it gives a much greater picture to the world, the unbelieving world, who Jesus is. You as an individual can only portray so much of who Christ really is. But if you get 10 people, if you get 50 people, if you get 100 people together, a composite of Jesus Christ comes together, and it's so much more powerful in that way. Does this make sense to you? And the enemy's attack, our ancient enemy's attack, is always to divide and conquer. It's always to isolate us. It's always not to live in community, so that that cannot happen. So the second thing I want to say is that the gospel of Jesus Christ existed in absolute stark contrast to any existing worldview among Greco-Romans of that day. We've talked about that. And that the gospel of Jesus Christ exists in absolute and stark contrast to the ruling worldview of our day. Only it's even more stark. There's even more of a contrast. So one of the ways in which ancient religions and the Christian faith overlapped was this. That anybody who worshipped any other god, when they worshipped that god, there was always this sense, even as they worshipped in a pagan fashion, there was always this sense that they had to appease their god through some kind of sacrifice because of some kind of deficiency in their life. That was universal. In fact, missiologists would say to you, that is universal today. That throughout much of the world, if you do missions and you go to some of the deep, dark places throughout the world, you will almost always run into a tribe or a people group who worship, and they may be worshiping the demons of the jungle or the demons of the river or whatever they're worshiping. They all have this sense in which they are insufficient, that there's something wrong about who they are as a person, and that those gods have to be appeased through some kind of personal sacrifice. So Christians and pagans in that day overlapped in that manner. And that was, in fact, a way that Christians could evangelize to pagans. They would say, you know how you're like offering sacrifices to Diana or to Zeus or to Mercury or whoever? Yeah. Well, you always have to keep doing that. Well, with our God, there's just been this once and for all sacrifice. And guess what? He paid the price. You and we don't have to pay that price anymore. Well, that was just like mind-blowing. But today, to convey to social elites within our culture that we are insufficient, that we are deficient, and that we have to live lives that are glorifying to God, and we have to recognize the sacrifice that Christ made to pay for our sins, that's absurdity. It's ridiculous. It's just a myth. And it's uninformed myth to them even then. So the contrast is even starker. It's even more graphic today than what it was in ancient Asia Minor or the Mediterranean Basin. It's in this way the world has degraded, not gotten better, degraded. So I'll just take a little bit of a rabbit trail here. That's one of the differences between how many people who espouse the worldview that I'm talking about, they see humanity as being involved in this inexorable climb into getting better and better and better and better and better, and it's going to result in something unbelievably good. Whereas Christians say, well, no, the peak of humanity was Adam and Eve. And since the fall, there's been this fall and this falling, and that at the end times, humanity will never be worse than in the end times. The end times is going to be the worst possible time. The end times in the future. So we live with our beliefs going in opposite directions in that regard. So, the third thing I want to say is that first century pagans eventually received the gospel of Christ not only as good news, but great news. Great news. They were burdened. They were weighed down. They were suffering under these impossible demands that could never be met by their gods and by their philosophies of life. So when Jesus Christ came along and when they heard and received it, it was great news. And they were able to receive it because of what they saw in believers and in Christians. And what they saw was absolute fidelity to Christ. And the counter-cultural practice of the fruits of the Spirit. The fruits of the Spirit, which come from the book of Galatians, chapter 5, verses 22 through 23. The fruit of the Spirit of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. That book, you know, Galatians, that was written to Christians in Asia Minor, telling people how to live. And living in this way lived was a stark contrast to how other people lived. Where vengeance was a good thing. Hating people who were from different places and different tribes. But Christians lived according to the fruit of the Spirit. And they distinguished themselves in that regard. And I got to believe that when Christians in this day and time live according to the fruits of the Spirit, that we distinguish ourselves too. Some of you continue to work, and some of you work in companies and organizations that are not Christian. If I use the word petty, does that make sense to you at all? Do you see pettiness in the workplace? Do you see gossip in the workplace? Do you see hate in the workplace? Do you see impatience in the workplace? But if you, as a Christian, live counter to that, in that kind of darkness, you shine pretty brightly. So today, most of the elites in Western civilization regard the good news as naive and uninformed news, as absurd news, as offensive news, as even dangerous and irresponsible news. You think I'm wrong? See what's happening in higher education and what their view of the Christian faith is. See what's happening in pop culture and Hollywood and places like that and see if I'm wrong about any of this right here. All of the major institutions that control and run our culture today are controlled by social elites who have no room, no place, no purpose for the Christian faith. So, I was wanting to be able to end on a more positive note, because I'm giving to you right now what the analysis is of the worldview that you and I live in and under in this, not only just in the United States, but in Western civilization. But I'm going to take a break here and I'm going to pick it up next week. But I want to say, and I'm going to move ahead a little bit, I want to say that the challenges and the burdens that we have, the potential burdens what I think will be eventually more and more in the way of persecution, that we have to train ourselves. We have to do exactly what Peter said to the Christians in Asia Minor. Remember the gospel. Remember this great and phenomenal salvation that Jesus Christ has accorded to us. remember that whatever pain or suffering we might sacrifice now or in the future, that it's temporary, that it won't last very long, and that what is waiting, what is guarded for us in heaven, is eternal life in Jesus Christ. That not only that, but that through these trials and temptations that may come our way, that we lean into them and allow them to polish us, to cleanse us, to burn the impurities out of our lives, so that in that fire, that Peter uses the word fire, that the impurities are burned off, and that we become more like Christ as a result. So next week, I'm going to share about two or three more of these observations, and then we're going to talk about what this worldview really is and what it's really about, and I'm going to give it a name. And then hopefully we can move on from there and understand. Look, let me just say this in conclusion. Have you ever been ill? Have you ever been affected by something, and so you had some malaise or you didn't feel well, but you couldn't figure out what was making you sick? Have you ever had that happen? Have you ever had something happen to you where it compromised your well-being in your life? And you're like, I don't know what this is. And you had symptoms, but you couldn't put a name to it. But then you went to the doctor, and he ran or she ran some tests, and you were able to determine through those tests and through your symptoms that you had this kind of illness. And the doctor gave it a name. And when you got the name, you were almost relieved. Because now that you have a name, you can have what? The treatment. So if any of you are feeling that you live in this world and there's this kind of malaise and that things are going on in our culture and it's impacting you and it's disaffecting you, you're like, what is going on here? What's happening? I want to give that name. I want to give it a name so that we can know then this is what it is. This is what it does, and this is how we fight against it. Does that make sense to you all? So this is the practical piece, I think. And it seems to me that what I'm trying to get at here is, in a very real way, what Peter was trying to get at those Christians who were living in Asia Minor at the time. So I'm going to pray, and then I'm going to ask the elders to come forward, and we will celebrate the Lord's Supper. As we celebrate the Lord's Supper and as you prepare your heart, will you pray that God gives you the ability to embrace and to love your fidelity and your obedience to Jesus Christ, and that you might represent Him well in all areas of your life through the practice of the fruits of the Spirit in the world in which you live. Would you pray for all of that and seal that to yourself